This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
There's a swift government crackdown, and hijinks ensue.
So this union of the werewolf mythology, or the lycan mythology, as you call them, from lycanthropy, and the fear around infection and the fear around prion disease, was there a moment that you came up with this union for yourself in the book?
Well, I was thinking about fantasies that have resonated through time, thinking about stories like Frankenstein. It's a prime example of this, where cultural unease is channeled. Frankenstein's creature embodies all of the anxiety swirling around the Industrial Revolution, the fear of science and technology, the fear of man playing God. The same thing goes for the Red Scare, McCarthyism, the way that that gave rise to the invasion of the body snatchers. You can think of the latest Batman films and how they very much parallel some of the things that are going on in contemporary America. You can think of the slew of apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic narratives that have come out since 9/11. And I was trying to tap into the anxieties of our times. And I was thinking about infection, for one. I mean, you need look no further than the storefronts or the countertops of any business establishment in America to see Purell oozing. You look to the headlines in our newspapers and magazines, and if there's a swine flu or bird flu or West Nile outbreak, you know, we're paralyzed by this. So I was thinking about infection, but I was also thinking about terrorism. And as these last few weeks have so unfortunately reminded us, terror owns us. Terror might be the most powerful emotion beyond even love, in the way that it can grip millions and paralyze us as a country.
And it's interesting, this theme of metamorphosis, because when you have a country that is terrorized, you see the way people who aren't lycans or werewolves, the way they change and deform in the name of security, or in the name of you know, safety for the populace, for instance.
Yeah, there's, you know, there are good guys and bad guys on both sides of this. My characters are the infected and they are the uninfected. My characters are men and women, young and old. They come from all sorts of different cultural and religious and geographic and economic backgrounds in order to provide these myriad perspectives on a very complicated issue.
Well, in doing research for our interview today, I was curious what the origins of lycanthropy were. So in researching it myself, I found a connection that seemed to also argue for a nice poetic resonance with prion disease. And I was curious if you'd come across it as well. But the name comes from the king of Arcadia, Lycon, who fed Zeus his own son to try to see if he'd notice, to test whether Zeus was really a deity or not. And when Zeus discovered that he was being fed his own son, he turned Lycon into a wolf. And so I was thinking, like, this, the prion diseases, when you have mad cow's disease and you have, like, cows being fed themselves.
It
sort of almost feels like a revolt of nature against human efficiency. Here we have this horrible system, food system, where we're, like, warping all the natural laws, and then nature comes roaring back in this prion disease. But in a sense, also is also the mythology of werewolves.
True enough. And if you look at the end of the novel, which I can't discuss because it's very spoiler-y, but its conclusion very much connects to the point that you just made, in that, well, some of us are being infected without even knowing it.
A lot of people have been making note of what they consider a leap for you from literary fiction into full-on horror genre fiction.
Yeah.
I didn't really have the same impression. To me, and I'm curious what your impression is as the writer, I didn't have the same impression of it being such a leap. It felt more like an extension of themes that you already were addressing in your other work, and some of those themes being wildness versus domesticity, the tensions between nature and culture, id versus ego, This runs through a lot of your fiction, whether it's in the Paris Review or whether it's Red Moon, full-on werewolves. And you even have in The Wilding a character who makes a suit of fur.
Yes,
an Iraqi vet who wanders with a sort of a precursor to this metamorphosis.
Yeah, I don't see this as a departure at all. A few people have said that. The only departure I can see is stylistically, in that this is an epic, sweeping novel, which has always been the kind of book that I've loved most. I love to be swept away. I love to be immersed in a narrative for weeks at a time. The most recent book series to do that to me is George R. R. Martin's Song of Fire and Ice saga. And I wanted to write that kind of book, and it took me so many years and so many failed novels to finally accomplish it. So I see a departure there, but as for the content, I feel in many ways I've been, if you look at my short story collections, even if there isn't a ghost, many of those are haunted stories. Some of those are creature in the woods stories. I've always been borrowing from the tropes of horror and from, I guess you could say, pulpier narratives. There's a revenge story in Refresh called The Killing, and there's a post-apocalyptic narrative in there. And anyways, my characters really have always been hairy on the inside. So, yeah, this is... I feel like this is Red Moon is the book that I've been working toward, that I've been wanting to write my whole life.
Do you feel like you've been moving more and more epic as you've proceeded from book to book? I know The Wilding feels much more like it's in a specific setting, a confined one, in fact, with very limited number of characters. And in this book, we are in so many different countries, different parts of the country, and I don't know how many points of view there are, but there are quite a few different characters that you flesh out in the book.
Yeah, you could think of The Wilding, my first published novel, but not my first novel, not by a long shot. I threw away thousands of pages before publishing it. You can think of The Wilding as kind of a negotiation, because up to that point I had been a successful short story writer, but unable to take on the long form, able to run a sprint, but not a marathon. So when I wrote The Wilding, as a kind of negotiation, it takes place in a small set. It has a small cast of characters. It all takes place in one weekend. And that's the book that taught me how to write in the long form. And in the process of doing so, my head was sort of rewired. And now it's actually difficult for me to write short stories. And Red Moon is this big sweeping narrative, and so is the next book, which is called The Deadlands. It comes out in June of 2014, and it's a post-apocalyptic reimagining of the Lewis and Clark saga. So it too, you know, you have to give an adequate amount of real estate to a quest like that.
We're talking today with Benjamin Percy about his new novel, Red Moon. So Ben, let's let our listeners hear some of the prose, if you have a section you wanted to read.
So I have many characters in the novel. One of them is Claire Forrester, and she is, I guess, one of the central storylines. She and Patrick Gamble are sort of the star-crossed lovers of the narrative. She is one of the infected, and her parents, though she doesn't know this at the time, have been part of the resistance for many years. And in fact, in the 60s, they were part of kind of a weather underground movement. So after the terrorist act that opens up the novel, there's a government response and her family is targeted. Claire does not know what is happening outside right this minute, as the small brigade of vehicles, the armored vans, the black sedans with government plates, appear at the end of her block with their headlights off. She lives in a wooded neighborhood, each house set back on a half-acre lot. There are no street lights, no sidewalk. The vehicles purr to a stop. Their doors swing open but do not close. Any noise that might bring Claire to the window, the stomp of boots along the asphalt, the clatter of assault rifles and ammunition clips, is muffled by the steady snowfall, a white shroud thrown over the night. She does not know about the tall man in the black suit and black necktie, his skull as hairless as a stone, who stands next to his black Lincoln Town Car. She does not know that he has his hands tucked into his pockets, or that the snow is melting against his scalp and dripping down his face, or that he is smiling slightly. She does not know that her father and mother are sitting at the kitchen table, drinking their way through a bottle of Merlot, not holding, but squeezing each other's hands in reassurance as they watch CNN, the coverage of what the president called a coordinated terror attack directed at the heart of America. So she does not know that, when the front door kicks open, splintering along its hinges, her father is holding the remote in his hand, a long black remote that could be mistaken for a weapon. She does not know that he stands up so suddenly his chair tips over and clatters to the floor, that he screams no and holds out his hand, the hand gripping the remote, and points it at the men as they come rushing through the entryway, the dark rectangle of night, with snow fluttering around them like damp, shredded paper. She only knows when she hears the crash, the screams, the rattle of gunfire, that she must run. She hasn't changed often, only a handful of times. Not only because it is forbidden, because she could be jailed for it, but because she doesn't like the way it makes her feel, so grotesquely other. And bruised for days afterward, her body's sudden shifting like the growing pains that make children twist under their sheets and cry out at night. She can smell the men now, deodorant and aftershave, cigarettes and gum, gun oil, the sulfur of their weapons' discharge. She can hear their harsh breathing, their voices calling out, clear! From different corners of the house, she can feel their footsteps pounding up the stairs toward her. Her skin itches horribly, as if bubbling over with hives, and then the hair bristles from it in a rush. Her gums recede and her teeth grind together in a mouth not yet big enough for them. Her bones stretch and bend and pop, and she yowls in pain as if she is giving birth, one body coming out of another. She always cries, tears of blood. This time her tears and mewling come from the pain, and also the dawning realization that everything, in an instant, has changed. But these thoughts are fleeting. The wolf in her has no time for them. Her mind sharpens to a singular focus. Survival is what matters. There is nothing else, no love or sadness or fear or worry. Only a needle stab of adrenaline that surges through her, sends her loping toward the window, toward the reflection she barely recognizes, hunched and misshapen and growing larger by the second. Then she crashes through herself, through the window. The glass shatters, and shards of it bite at her. There is no roof to scuttle across, no lattice or gutter to climb down. There is instead the blackness of the night, the emptiness of the air she falls through, flipping and twisting as the wind shrieks in her ears and the ground rushes up to meet her. Splinters of glass, mixed up with the snow, sparkle all around her. 2 inches have already fallen, but that isn't enough to cushion a fall from a second-story window. She lands on all fours, rolling and thudding forward, sliding across the short expanse of lawn, smearing away the snow in a ragged teardrop to reveal the green grass beneath. A tree at the edge of the lawn offers a hammer blow to her chest. Her breath is gone. Her wrist blazes. The night seems to close upon her for a moment. And then she draws in a sucking gasp. Her window throws a square of light broken up by triangles and hexagons of yellow and orange that spotlight her body, the spotlight blackened a moment later when the men charge into her room and pursue her exit. She shakes away the pain and leaps to her feet and sees the man, the tall man in the black suit. 20 yards away, he observes her with his head cocked curiously. And then he begins to walk, and then run, his long arms slashing the air toward her.
I hope that if you aren't doing your book on tape, that you're running out after this and firing the person and doing it, because that's just a great reading.
No, I did do it. I did.
You did do the book on tape.
Yeah, it was 8 hours a day in the studio. They're hardcore.
Wow.
For 7 days. And on day two, my throat just hadn't done enough push-ups. I wasn't ready for that kind of work, and I was coughing up blood. So if you listen on disc two, it sort of sounds like...
Well, that's
the ambiance.
It's good for the theme of the book, for sure.
Yeah.
So let's talk more about your fascination with wildness and wilderness. I know it obviously runs through most of your work, and you look at the wilding as sort of a meditation on a diminishing wildness. We have an impending development that's going to happen in the wilderness where the setting is. And each generation of men seems to be less capable and self-directed.
More watered down.
So this book is sort of the flip side of that, in a sense that it really has to do with the wildness rebellion within all of us and that struggle between over... domestication and wildness. Tell us a little bit more why you keep returning to this as a organizing principle.
Maybe it has something to do with growing up in Oregon. Maybe it has something to do with growing up on 27 acres of land and having a father who was a hunter and a fisherman, with a mother who butchered all of our meat, who raised all of our vegetables, who was an obsessive camper and hiker and botanist. And Oregon is all about these intersections of wilderness and civilization, sort of smashing up against each other. And I grew up moving irrigation pipe to make my Coca-Cola money and mucking out horse stalls and mending barbed wire fences. And so I guess I was always, in addition to exploring the landscape on vacations, on weekend expeditions, I was also sort of involved with the taming of it. But as for, you know, Red Moon as a whole, I guess that, you know, one of the reasons that the werewolf myth resonates with people is that we all, as a result of rage or exhaustion, drugs, drink, we all have come to regret our behavior the next morning. And Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is the most famous werewolf story. The Incredible Hulk is one of the most famous werewolf figures. And these stories are about the id unleashed. They're about the wildness contained in all of us that sometimes comes out when we're pushed to the edge and sometimes comes out when the shades go down and we know no one's looking.
You mentioned living on a ton of land, and it sounds like having a lot of self-directed time as a kid growing up, too. And it reminds me of something that Michael Chabon said about how he laments the way parenting is today, where everything is curated by the parents, and the parents are always sort of on the margins of any activity, and it's not allowing children to form their own parentless maps. And that really feels like something that you address in Red Moon, in the sense of the two main characters, the lover dynamic between Patrick and Claire. Both of them sort of are forced due to circumstance to make their own maps in the world without the guidance of parents. Sort of solving that nature, mm-hmm. culture, mm-hmm. wilderness, domesticity divide on their own.
Sure, sure. Yeah, that's something I think about a lot. I was raised in a sort of Huck Finnish manner, in that I could depart at dawn and come back at dusk without much in the way of supervision. I was ducking under barbed wire fences and shooting my BB gun and building tree forts and building dams in the river and getting into quite a lot of trouble sometimes when I approached my teenage years. But that sort of dreamscape that I lived in, I mean, when I was roaming the forest with my trusty sidekick, a German shepherd named Heidi, you know, I was a knight or I was a cowboy. And as a result of that, I feel like it was training ground for the novelist I've become. And I'm trying as often as I can to be, as a parent, more hands-off, because the culture of today is helicopter parents are the norm, and every minute of your child's day is scheduled. And I worry about them. I mean, I don't just mean my children, but children in general, being able to have that independence, that self-direction, and just a creative impulse to fill up the empty space with whatever their mind might come up with. Mm.
Speaking of Oregon as a character, it's not only your psychic landscape from your childhood, but you mentioned this juxtaposition of extreme nature and extreme culture sort of jammed up against each other. Do you think that's why we keep seeing a lot of these genre stories set here, whether it's Twin Peaks or Twilight or the TV show Grimm and now Red Moon? Like, is there something sinister or haunting about that juxtaposition, do you think, that is specific to the Pacific Northwest? Or
Well, it is a kind of fairyland. You need only traipse through Forest Park here in the middle of Portland to realize that. But, you know, it's just such a dynamic environment. The state is fragmented in so many ways. We have plains, we have desert, we have alpine areas, we have rainforests, we have lush valleys, we have the coast. It's like the whole country smashed into one place. And we have all these different cultures smashed together here as well, and all these different political leanings tangled up and economic divides. And I guess you could say, when it comes to it being fearsome, that, you know, my upbringing, I guess, was more fearsome than most, in that, you know, several people that I knew died as a result of snowmobiling accidents or skiing accidents or drownings. I encountered death on a regular basis, as my father would take us on hunting trips, and you know, I would be involved in the butchering of the animals. I spent several summers on archaeological expeditions, and during that time would, you know, happen upon rattlesnakes constantly. And one unfortunate summer, I was a teenager at the time, so I regret this now, but you know how it is when you're an 18-year-old dude. You know, I killed many rattlesnakes and collected their rattles and ate them all.
Wow.
and so, you know, it's just, it is a bit of a dreamscape. There's a lot of, even though most of the West has been tamed, there are pockets of wildness still out there.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking to Benjamin Percy about his new novel, Red Moon. Another thing I'd love to just touch on is the way you're characterized as a masculine writer. And I think part of that is your voice, and part of that are the themes of wilderness and self-reliance that are in your fiction. But it also struck me that in Red Moon, despite all of the surface level masculinity with the baring of teeth and the resistance movement and a lot of action, that really the really powerful characters in this book seem to be the women.
I'd say yes, that the women are not only the most powerful characters, but my favorite characters. Miriam in particular is the character who surprised me most, and whose story I most want to continue with, in part because she needs to exact her revenge upon another one of the characters in this novel. So I think that, you know, I'm I'm classified as masculine in part because, you know, I sound like the bowels of the earth when I speak, and you know, I stand with my legs apart and have big hairy sideburns and all the rest of that. But the heroes of this book are the female figures, the women warriors.
Well, before we end today, can you tell us a little bit more about your next novel, the post-apocalyptic Lewis and Clark novel? Is that, I'm assuming it's genre fiction in some regard, as it's a speculative retelling of history?
If you imagine the states 250 years from now following a nuclear apocalypse, we have some outposts of humanity. And the idea behind this expedition this time around is that they are reuniting the states.
Interesting.
And Clark is this really fierce, hard-headed woman. And Lewis is sort of a feeble-bodied scholar. And there are elements of magic in the novel that are grounded still in science and that I've spent a lot of time studying environmental disaster and mutation and the possibilities of evolution.
Oh, that sounds great.
So I guess you could call it sci-fi or maybe cli-fi if you think about how the climate and environmental transformation is so much at the heart of it.
Nice. Well, it's great having you on Between the Covers today.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
We were talking today with author Benjamin Percy about his latest novel, Red Moon. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
The Oregon Cartoon Institute and KBOO Community Radio are proud to present Harry Smith, PDX, a history and arts education project. Harry Smith in the Pacific Northwest, a panel discussion at the Hollywood Theater, will be held May 16th at 3 o'clock. There will be a Harry Smith seance featuring 16mm films by Harry Smith, plus writers and film directors whose works highlight Harry Smith's life, on May 16th at 7 p.m., at the Hollywood Theater. Finally, at the Harry Smith Free For All at the Cleaners, May 19th, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., there will be a series of short interactive presentations about the life and work of Harry Smith. More information about Harry Smith PDX can be found online at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the page under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is proud to help sponsor the Triangle production version of Ave Maria, a musical about the 20th century's most famous Greeks, Aristotle Onassis and Maria Callas, starring Bruce Blanchard and Amy Jo Holliday. The musical will take place at The Sanctuary, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Ave Maria runs from May 2nd to May 26th. More information and tickets may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, salads, and wraps. Located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
Is she there? Hi, I'm Don Merrow, and I am having the pleasure of talking with Eve Ensler. Miss Ensler is an American playwright. She's a performer, a feminist activist, and she's best known for the Vagina Monologues, which premiered in 1996. Miss Ensler, are you there?
I'm here.
Thanks very much for taking the time to talk to me and talk to the KBOO audience.
Absolutely.
You're coming to the Pacific Northwest on a book tour. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
Well, I'm actually here. I'm in Portland now, and I have been on a tour now. This is my 13th city. It's been an amazing tour across America and then across Canada, and it's a tour for In the Body of the World, which is my new memoir, which is really about coming back into your body after trauma, after leaving your body at a young age, after leaving my body at a young age, and how cancer and the work in the Congo were transforming agents of reconnection.
Can you talk a little bit about that work in the Congo?
Yes, with pleasure. I think about 7 years ago, I was invited to the Congo at the bequest of a wonderful doctor named Dr. Denis Mukwege, who's an OBGYN and the head of something called the Panzi Hospital in Bukavu. He has been working now for 14 years in the midst of a terrible economic war that's being fought for the minerals of the Congo by Western corporations who use